Welcome to the Lawyering Up podcast with Jarrett Ferrantino, Edward Ceramboli, and sometimes Greg Fellerman. Lawyering Up aims to be a podcast that two litigation lawyers, sometimes three, tackle civil law, criminal law, lawmakers, lawbreakers, and life itself with interviews that entertain, educate, and inform. We're lawyers. We love to talk. We love to talk about everything. We're going to consult with the best experts in the respective fields we discuss, and we're going to hammer it out litigation style for all of you.
Welcome to the Lawyer Up Podcast. This is the second half of our special two-part inaugural episode, so if you haven't already heard part one, now is the time to go back and give that a listen. We now join Greg Fellerman and Ed Ceramboli, along with attorney Jarrett Ferrantino, as they talk with Carmen Ambrosino, former CEO and director of Wyoming Valley Alcohol and Drug Services, Inc.
Well, Carmen, and this is not a problem, you know, it's not a problem that'll be solved by the medical societies and the lawyers. It's going to be solved by...
Or the jails.
That's correct. And we're going to talk about that, too. But the physicians... A physician who's treating this needs to understand emotional and mental health and well-being and that component of it as well. So what is the success rate? And I don't even know if this is the right question. What is the recovery rate of individuals who have been abusing these opioids in this manner?
Let me qualify that by adding this to that. What is the recovery rate of people that are motivated, inspired, and determined to change their life and stop using chemicals? It can be as high as 80 to 85%. When you factor in, however, the unmotivated, the unwilling to change.
The court compelled,
then it can be as low as 30 to 35%. And so people will ask me silly questions over 41 years as a professional. Did you ever have anyone who recovered from drugs or alcohol? 41 years, did I ever have anyone? That's one person recover from drugs and alcohol.
Right. If the answer is no, you're the wrong guy. I got to tell you.
I love your sense of humor.
So what we're talking about here is there is an opportunity, if treated the right way, to get back, to come back from this epidemic.
Yes.
That the reforms have to be in medicine, in spirituality, in treating it as a mental, and I do think that we talk about the change in the caliber of patient you have or the nature of the patient you had was white collar. That in a way has taken away some of the stigma, not all of the stigma, because let's face it, we did not begin rolling up our sleeves and digging into this problem until it started affecting folks on an everyday basis and in everybody's lives. And when it was a city problem, it was largely ignored or written off.
Right on target.
Has the fact that it's permeated into middle class America, white America,
white America.
There's no boundary.
Right, but I mean, when it went there.
Doesn't matter.
That's correct. And when it went there, did that rip the Band-Aid off, so to speak?
Rip the Band-Aid off, and the escalation of the numbers are frightening, and that has helped, unfortunately, through loss of life, that has helped uncover this as a major pandemic. Without those issues, without it going in the middle class and higher socioeconomic, and the numbers are just absolutely frightening. These are human beings that are dying. But you also uncovered in your comment one of the other roadblocks. One would think that anyone with a drug problem who wants help could get it. Only 10% of addicts ever get help because the system is set up that there's very little money. Despite what you hear from statesmen, I won't call them politicians, from statesmen, and from different aspects, there's very few dollars going into. You know, if you look at many counties, they have $27-28 million going into criminal justice to run prisons, and they have about $2 million going in for drug and alcohol, and it's prevention, education, treatment, aftercare, follow up.
It's shameful.
I think if anything has come out, been born out of this, and something I could certainly speak to are the changes in, you're not going to arrest and prosecute this problem. You have to rehabilitate this problem. And I have seen, you know, locally and beyond, the implementation of drug courts and programs set up to give somebody the Damocles of a criminal charge hanging over your head. And we talk about motivation of addicts to say, hey, if you can do a year clean being tested by us, we'll take this arrest and it will go away. But you have to commit to doing the work here. And that may not be the best motivation, but it's a positive motivation for people. And we've had success rates. And I've seen a change in the prosecutors I work with, a new attitude. You know, a lot of drugs, I wouldn't say they've been decriminalized, but the possession of certain drugs have been reduced to a point where drug court is an option. Probation with drug testing is an option to keep people on the straight and narrow, and you're not jailing the problem. And that's some of the changes. We're also seeing a lot of marijuana changes across the country. We're seeing marijuana legalization efforts, and that's another show we could talk about that. But if anything good has come out of the opioid epidemic, it's the stigma is starting to change. It's starting to clarify. And I think that there is a renewed dedication in that world at rehabilitation.
One of the things I've done the last 5 years of my career after retirement, so I'm still in the field, is to help startup programs. New programs get licensed in Pennsylvania. There are six facilities in Northeast Pennsylvania that are now here that 1 year ago were not. However, I need to tell you that zoning hearings for every single one of them were very painful. Screaming, yelling, threats, needing police escorts, me home, because I'm there testifying that addicts are good people with a bad disease. A lot of individuals.
I feel people feel that way because it's in my neighborhood now.
It's, yeah. It's the not in my backyard.
Not in my backyard. I mean, what happened?
Wilkes-Barre City just turned down a shelter for homeless, and the main issue was there's going to be drug addicts in there. Like I said before, my whole caseload was professional, white-collar guys and gals, and they're drug addicts too. But we want to only see the ones that make the headlines. And
how do we counterbalance that, though? How do you get people to open up? How did you win the ones that you won? Like you said, you won six that weren't here a year ago, 5 years ago. How did you win? Like, what was the...
The courageous people in recovery who put aside their anonymity and confidentiality, who come forward oftentimes... Really? From walks of life, physicians, doctors, dentists, lawyers, et cetera.
Well, we have a tremendous success story right now in Luzerne County, one of the public defenders. I mean, she was an addict. That is a true, it's unbelievable.
Amen.
Absolutely unbelievable. You've worked with doctors for the last 40 years, and you've kind of seen, you know, you saw in the beginning, nobody prescribed really opioids unless you had some very, very, very significant pain-causing problem. And then you saw it shift to, as Greg said, you know, now they're given opioids for a back strain. Now that the education maybe has caught up and people understand just how powerful these opioids are, how addictive they truly are you now seeing the same shift in a philosophical shift in the doctors who are prescribing these opioids? Because, I mean, let's be honest, if doctors aren't prescribing them, doesn't matter how much they're manufacturing, how much they're distributing, you still need doctors to prescribe them. So you're starting to see that shift as
overwhelming shift. Yes. Yes, we are. Good point. And yes, we're seeing that.
The other thing I've seen, I'll give an example. My daughter just had a hip surgery and they prescribed her an opioid, and she knew, one, she only wanted to take it for a very, very short period of time, and she knew the dangers of continuing to take it. She's 17 years old. And I think you're seeing that with a lot of people. Now they know the dangers of, even though it's prescribed, I don't want to be on this very long because I know what can happen. Have you been seeing that with
someone? Yes. Oh, absolutely.
They're more educated. People
know. The consumer's more educated. Yeah. And the healthcare professional.
So it's a combination of both.
Yes, absolutely. More seminars on that, more workshops on that.
And she needed the medicine for the 2 days. Well, she was in pain, major surgery, but hey, then went to a leave or something else.
Yes.
Way down the chain. And I think that's part of, people are now more educated. They're not just, the doctors hand me this bag of pills, I got to take the whole pills. And that's what was happening.
And I think that although we may have turned the corner, we have a long way to go.
Long way to go. Oh, yeah. Yes. And long way to go.
On that, along those same lines, My son, 5 years ago, separates his shoulder. We're out in Colorado. He's a snowboarder, separates his shoulder. We're flying out there. He's under the age of 18 at the time, so he can't just go and get the prescription filled. Well, the he separates his shoulder. The doctor out there had prescribed him a 30 days worth of OxyContin. 30 days worth of OxyContin. You know, we get out there. My wife flips out. She says, absolutely no way. I mean, you're going to give a 16-year-old, 17-year-old kid a 30-day supply of OxyContin. As you said, I mean, he's hooked. You know, he's going to be hooked like that. Yeah. You know, as Greg said, I've also seen the shift just in our own kids where they're so much more educated on, you know, on this just in the last 5 years.
Drugs,
where, I mean,
alcohol, we see
there's a great apprehension, at least the education.
They're way smarter than we were.
But again, there's still those out there in pain, that emotional pain, that physical pain that will drive the desire.
Absolutely.
You know, maybe they don't desire to become addicted, but they do desire to escape that pain, which will always be the impetus. Now, we talk about, I think, you've done a fantastic job of talking about the nature of the addiction and really the cause of the problem. And we find ourselves as attorneys now in this litigation, and we don't profess to be able to solve the problems you've been able to solve, okay? And we talked a little bit about drug court, but now we also have this opioid litigation, which is the term of art that it's been referred to as. And so people listening understand, we're not representing those individuals that have died. We're not representing the families that have been broken as a result, because there may not be a clear path in the law for those folks at this point. Where we're seeing the litigation is on behalf of communities like Luzerne County, which has been called in national publications and news reports ground zero for the opioid epidemic. We see we're pursuing claims for these local municipalities for the collateral damage and the costs that they've been hit with, the damages that our governments locally, countywide, statewide have been hit with. And we talked to so many communities here. Eddie and Greg and I had gone out and met with individuals in these communities. And here's the cost people don't think about. We talk about generation of grandparents raising kids, coming to children and youth services. We talk about our jails being full of individuals whose crimes are drug-fueled or drugs themselves. We have coroner's offices dealing with these deaths and taxed in a way. We have the funding of drug courts and the changes in our criminal system. All of these things are being paid for by...
You forgot something.
What's that?
Every time we went out and we talked to the police and firemen, you know what now is in every single solitary budget?
Narcan.
Mm-hmm. Guess what wasn't in the budget 5 years ago?
Narcan.
You're right.
Now, I mean, these guys are, they got Narcan in the budget. They have to go through extensive training regarding dealing with somebody who's on fentanyl or on heroin or on an opioid. When you're talking about touching them, now, you know, they can't even grab these drugs and take them because they're so powerful.
Right.
If they don't have gloves on,
right.
They don't.
And who's paying? You know who's paying for it? I mean, although the counties and we're paying for
taxpayers.
It. I mean, so that's the. So what we're seeking to recover in these lawsuits are those costs, and that's something certainly worth mentioning. And you know, everyone was learning as we began to go out to these communities. We were seeing we didn't find one community that wasn't impacted on their bottom line. You know, it's resulted in raises in taxes and those things. And this is what makes this. There's the emotional component, the human component,
yes.
The financial component makes it truly a pandemic.
Yeah. Just a comment on the Narcan for the viewer, and that is that Governor Wolf had the Physician General in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania standing order for Narcan. Naloxone is what it is. And that standing order does allow anyone, including the family, to go into most pharmacies. All pharmacies should have it, but for whatever reason, they don't. But you can go into a pharmacy that carries Narcan and get it without a prescription, because that prescription has been written by the Physician General in the Commonwealth. And if you can even go online to get a copy of that if you want. If there are pharmacists or owners of pharmacies that are going to question you, you can walk in with the actual prescription online from Pennsylvania. That's a standing order. And it's not only for EMTs or professionals or doctors. If you have a loved one in your family who has some type of an opioid problem, heroin or any other prescribed opioid, please get the Narcan. It comes in the spray form. You can get it. And this has been used, I believe the number is 23,000 times in Pennsylvania.
That's
already
23 more thousand lives added on.
Yes.
So just for those that don't know what Narcan is a narcotic that reverses the effects of heroin.
That's correct.
And brings someone on the brink of death back.
That's correct. On the brink of death after an opioid overdose, you can spray this Narcan in the nostrils, and believe it or not, that person will wake up and be alive.
Speaking of Narcan, did you see this week in the news there was a new strain of opioid that's maybe Narcan resistant?
Well, carfentanil has been a strain. Heroin with carfentanil has given EMTs a lot of difficulty. Mm-hmm. If there's another one, I'm not aware of it.
I just saw the piece this week on the news. I didn't get all the info, but there's something now, a new thing they're worried about. An opioid that is resistant to Narcan.
You have to hit them several times with the Narcan when you have fentanyl and carfentanil-laced heroin.
Carl, I wanted to circle back for a minute to the treatment aspect of this and kind of what the future looks like for these addicts. In terms of treatment, and Jared had mentioned, and you had talked about getting to the root of the problem, and that it's a physical addiction, it's a psychological addiction. So, you know, treatment, you're going to need a psychological component, a spiritual component. But from a physical standpoint, how do you go from being addicted to opioids, and then what is the next step? Is there a step down?
Detoxification is the next step.
You know, after the detoxification, then does this person, you know, man, woman, you know, are they looking at some type of proactive medication, Suboxone, methadone, something of that nature, kind of for a prolonged period of time? And if so, like, why? I mean, why is that a necessary component of the overall treatment cycle?
There are some opioid addicts in recovery, especially the early part of it, who do need medication-assisted therapy, which is known as MAT. And in Pennsylvania, if your medical assistance approved as a facility, that's now mandated. You will not get MA reimbursement unless you do have an MAT component in your treatment program. But good treatment programs offer an MAT component with regard to methadone, buprenorphine, the Suboxone, mm-hmm. or Subutex, Naloxone.
And that's a challenge we've seen in the jails, too, where folks needed therapy or rehab, too. We're treating individuals that are incarcerated, oftentimes coming in off the street, addicted to the opioids, and needing medically assisted rehab has been a real challenge.
But the issue is, not everyone needs it. And so, like I said before, we seem to miss the middle. We do an assessment evaluation after detoxification, and we determine two things: how far the progression is and the level of treatment that a person needs. Now, levels of treatment are anything from outpatient to what's known as partial hospitalization. It's still outpatient, but it's elongated. Your inpatient rehab, halfway house, a transitional living program. That's determined after detox, after the person is clear of the chemicals, opioids in this case. That assessment evaluation, assuming we get honest information from the addict and significant others, we can now put together a treatment plan that consists of what is the best level of care for that individual. That's at the time where we also will determine what percentage of those opioid patients are going to need medication-assisted treatment. And so we try to link that particular patient with a treatment program who can meet their needs. Now, when you throw in the fact that the other roadblocks in the way are a lot of insurance companies will pay oftentimes for the first time in rehab, are reluctant to pay the second or third time, are not reluctant to pay for diabetics who relapse, or heart disease patients, or cancer patients. But we, for some reason, there is what's called a parity, P-A-R-I-T-Y, law, where mental health and drug and alcohol is supposed to be treated similarly to all your other physical ailments and diseases. But that's on paper. When you add human beings to that mix and stir, you have people who make judgment calls that sit in offices. So I believe the treatment should be on demand. I believe the detox should be on demand. If you detoxed 3 days ago and you relapsed again in the 72 hours, you should be able to go back in without being put on a list by someone who says, well, they were just here. So what? If you understand addiction and chemical dependency, you will know that there. One of the interesting things that I take with me is that there are people who failed many, many, many times at recovery. Then they finally got it. The light went on. Their mommies, their daddies, their grandmas, grandpas, aunts and uncles, they're influencing children and community. They are making good decisions now that are benefiting other individuals in this community. Had we given up on those individuals, one strike and you're out. It used to be three strikes and you're out, by the way, not only in baseball, but in addiction. Insurance companies had a clause until this parity legislation came out that said if you failed rehabilitation three times, your card was no longer good for inpatient.
But Carmen, failing, you'd agree with me, is part of the healing. I mean, you said the light went on. I mean, how many times did Edison fail at the light bulb? We don't talk about how many thousands of times he failed. We talk about when it worked.
How many times did Greg fail at high school?
But I think, we're talking about an addiction
that the disease of addiction,
right, that hits you at every level. If you didn't fail physically, you're going to fail emotionally this time. If you didn't fail emotionally, you're going to fail spiritually, you know, and that's so. The other thing is people don't realize not only is their drug part of their lives in shambles, if you're maintaining an addiction at this level, you're financially in shambles. Your romantic relationship's probably in shambles. Your familial relationship is in shambles. You have gone to hell in a handbasket, and your only escape hasn't been rehab, it's been drugs. So this is a healing at every level. And I think that we learn from the best success stories are those wrought with failure. I mean, you know,
got to learn from your failure.
That's it, absolutely. No.
But you know, the interesting point that I didn't realize is that the insurance companies play such a role in letting people get recovery. And
yes,
in our world, we fight with insurance companies all the time. We're very used to it, but they doesn't seem like they really understand the complexities of addiction and what needs to be done. What can they do better to educate those insurance companies so they're not having those hurdles? Because, look, at the end of the day, the insurance companies, they rule the world at this point. So how do we do a better job of handling them?
No longer do the drug companies, right, of this litigation stuff.
The only thing that has worked, in my opinion, is to legislate them. To try to reason with them, to try to point out statistics or research. When you legislate and say we have a new law called parity legislation and you no longer can discriminate, and anyone who is discriminated can call the insurance company or department in the state and will advocate on their behalf. I think that's key.
How are their legislators when you approach them on these issues? Are they receptive and they want to work with you? Or do you find them pushing back? Saying,
they do, but like every other aspect of the community, there's so much on their plate that they hear bits and pieces. And one of the things I said to the legislature years ago, a subcommittee, was that when I started my career in drug and alcohol as a clinician, as a counselor, 100% of my time went to face-to-face contact of getting people well. With the advent of forms, accountability, more forms, 48% of my time goes now for face-to-face. 52% goes for non-client related activities.
The bureaucracy.
Paperwork. And they sat there and said, oh my God, we've got to change that. And they haven't.
Same problem.
Yeah, they give you more forms to change.
Yeah.
Well, Carmen, I think that first of all, thank you so much for
being
here.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a real pleasure.
I know our listeners are going to learn a lot, if we have any listeners out there. But I certainly learned a lot. I'm a listener, and I will listen again. Because I knew you'd be a great guest, and I really enjoyed it.
I do have one final question, though,
sure.
Before we bring this thing in for a landing, because being on the front lines of drugs and addiction, you know what's coming into Pennsylvania very soon? They're going to legalize marijuana.
Yes.
And from your unique perspective, what do you think of that? It's going to happen. So
this could be a teaser for the next show.
Yeah. What do you think? What do you think is going to
happen?
Hour two. I mean, are you a proponent? Are you an opponent? And if so, you know, which way and why?
I think the best way to answer that is that if people sat in my shoes for 41 years and saw the impact of marijuana on people's lives, and people don't want to hear the terminology gateway drug, they haven't sat in the trenches for 41 years and they want to debate me. I'm totally opposed to it. I think it's a gigantic mistake. America has legalized nicotine and alcohol, and look what we've done with those. I think 10 years downrange, we will come to the realization that this will be a nightmare. The medical use of marijuana, the non-smokable medical use for your wasting diseases, I certainly comply with. But the legalization, now I see where there's a new law as of last night that's being proposed where you can grow it in your own home. It's all about the almighty dollar. That's what it's about. And I think they're making a big mistake. And let me say this. 41 years later in these trenches, not one politician has called Carmen Ambrosino for his viewpoint.
Because they don't want the
because
answer.
Because they don't want.
They know the
they
answer.
They don't want my input because that they certainly know what I'm going to say.
Because you might actually tell them the truth.
Amen.
Yeah, why would they want to hear that?
Yeah, right.
No. Well, Carmen, really, I mean,
thank you so much.
Really, this has been a lot of fun for us, and I really enjoyed, you know, having you as our first guest on our first episode. So thank you.
It's my honor. Real pleasure. Enjoyed the give and take as well. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Lawyer Up Podcast, a production of Fellerman and Ceramboli. This episode was edited and polished by NX2 Marketing. To learn more about the topics discussed in this show, or if you have a question for our legal team, visit fellermanlaw.com. Please subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcast.